My name's James. I said if you haven't heard me before, this isn't my real voice. I've got a cold, so hopefully the extra or, you know, a bit of authority in this sermon. So this morning we're looking at Luke 23. Or we're looking at a picture of a crown of thorns. I didn't bring my Bible up with me, so I can't even read from the Bible. There we go. Thank you. Luke 23:26-43. As the soldiers led him away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the childless. Blessed are the childless women, the women that never bore and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if the people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry? Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there along with the criminals, one on his right and the other on his left. Jesus said, 'Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing.' And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, 'He saved others. Let him save himself if he is God's Messiah, the chosen one.' The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine, vinegar, and said, 'If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself.' There was a written notice above him which read, 'This is the king of the Jews.' One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him, 'Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us.' But the other criminal rebuked him. 'Don't you fear God?' he said, 'since you are under the same sentence. We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong.' Then he said, 'Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom.' Jesus answered him, 'Truly, I tell you today, you will be with me in paradise.'" So one day, a beautiful sunny day, much like this one, I thought, you know what, today is the type of day I would love to share with God. So let me see if I can find God today. So I thought, well, where do you go when you want to find things? You go to the internet, don't you? Everything's on the internet. So I went to Google, put God into Google, and there's a lot of stuff on the internet about God, but you can't actually find God on the internet. I didn't know if you knew that, but you can't actually find, he's not there. So I thought, okay, well, where else? Well, I know, it's a beautiful day. People say you can see God in nature, so I'll go out and I'll find God in nature. So I went outside and I looked around at the trees and the sun and everything. And, you know, I thought I could see hints of God, but God wasn't there either. So I thought, well, I know some people think God is within you, so why don't I look inside myself and I'll find God there. That's pretty depressing, actually. Didn't work. Didn't find God. So I thought, I know, the Bible. How could I be so stupid? You can always find God in the Bible. If you can't find God, the Bible at least will tell you where you can find God. So I got my Bible down off the shelf, you know, blew the dust off, opened it, read it, closed it, put it back on the shelf, and I haven't looked at it since. Because it did tell me where you can find God, but I didn't really like what it said. Because it said to me that if there's one guaranteed way to meet God, all you have to do is get yourself crucified. When I was training for the ministry, I had to write a dissertation, and I'd already decided I wasn't going to do something purely academic. I wanted to do something practical that I thought would help me as a sort of minister, as caring for people. So I decided I was going to write my dissertation on the subject of suffering. And the title I gave my dissertation was, "What Are the Consequences of a Sacramental Understanding of Suffering?" Because even when you're not trying to be academic, you have to at least make it sound like you're trying to be academic. And what it meant, what my dissertation was really about, what are the consequences of a sacramental understanding of suffering? What I was really trying to say is, what if suffering is a place where God has committed to meet us? What if suffering is actually a place where God can be found? Suffering makes it hard, I think, to have faith at times, because if there's one thing that suffering does, there's one thing we can guarantee that suffering does, is it distorts our perspective. You know what it's like when you've got a sore back and your back's killing you? You know how much harder it is to love your neighbour when you're in pain? You know what it's like when you've got a toothache? It's a lot harder to pray, isn't it? It's a lot harder to seek God when you've got a toothache. You know what it's like when you're feeling depressed or anxious or discouraged? God seems to be gone, absent. He's not there. Well, nothing's changed. People haven't changed. God hasn't changed. What's changed is us. Suffering sort of changes our way of viewing the world, changes the way we look at things, distorts our perspective. I think it's rare to meet someone who is able to suffer and yet be able to keep their perspective, to keep their eyes kind of fixed on the truth. I think Jesus was one of those rare people. We can see this morning from the passage, he's been flogged for this. He's carrying the cross on his back to his own execution. And yet he still has the presence of mind to pass on to these women who are weeping and wailing for him, say, actually, worse is coming for you. Don't sort of get carried away now. Worse is coming for you. He still has the strength of character, the awareness of who he is, to actually offer forgiveness when he's being crucified. Think about that. Think how hard it is to forgive people when you've stubbed your toe. Think how hard it would be to forgive someone who has crucified you. Yet Jesus still has the strength of character to do that. On the cross itself, he's still able to reach out to a villain who's being crucified alongside him. He's still able to think about others and the needs of others in the middle of his sort of being executed. It's a rare person, I think, who doesn't let suffering, their own suffering, sort of distort their perception and dictate how they act. How do we respond when we suffer? I think in this passage that we read this morning, I think we can see two clear responses to suffering, two ways in which we may respond to suffering, even without considering Jesus' response. I see these in the conversation that is had between Jesus and these two men on the cross. I think the response of those two men on the cross to their situation to Jesus kind of can encapsulate the way we choose to respond when we're suffering. On the one hand, you have the one criminal who says, if you're the Christ, save yourself and us. Essentially, you know, if you're who you say you are, do something about this situation. If you are really as powerful as you say you are, if you are really God, why are you letting this bad thing happen to me? Does that sound familiar to anyone? Does that sound like something you might have thought yourself or said yourself? There's one response to suffering right there. If God exists, he should do something about the situation I'm in. Otherwise, I'm not interested. Otherwise, what's the point? Not interested in a God who doesn't fix my problems. That's one response right there. But then there's the other response. The criminal who says to the first, are you stupid? We deserve this, but this guy, he's done nothing wrong. Yet he's here with us. And then he turns to Jesus and says, remember me when you come into your kingdom. There's a different response to suffering. A response that says, here I am, I'm suffering, and God is right here with me in the middle of it. Why? Why is God with me in this moment? Well, he is. So I will trust him. I will choose to put all my eggs into his basket, so to speak. Because it's funny timing for this criminal. He's dying. It's the wrong time to back the wrong horse. This is it. This is his last chance. This is the wrong time to throw your lot in with Jesus. He'd have every reason to reject Jesus because Jesus is being crucified. Can't be the Messiah if you're being crucified. Yet this is the place where he chooses to trust Jesus. The first criminal, he uses his suffering as a reason to reject Christ. The second criminal, well, his suffering is the place where he meets Christ. It's the place where he responds to God. G.K. Chesterton said this, "Hope means hoping when things are hopeless. As long as matters really are hopeful, hope is mere flattery or platitude. It is only when everything is hopeless that hope begins to be a strength at all. Like all the Christian virtues, it is as unreasonable as it is indispensable." Do you get what he's saying here? What he's saying is it's no big thing to say, oh yes, I have faith in God when life is going well, when the sun's shining and you've got no problems and the bills are paid. Yeah, that's not real faith. That's not really the sort of Christian faith. That's not really the virtue of faith. You only really have faith when you have a reason not to believe and yet choose to believe anyway. You only have faith when God seems to be absent, when there's a million and one good reasons to just walk away and give up, and yet you say, no, I'm sticking with this. That's faith. There's a guy on a cross in the middle of suffering with every reason to reject Christ, and he says, I believe. That's the moment he chooses to believe. That's what faith looks like, if you were wondering. One of my favourite examples of faith can be found in the Old Testament, story many of you probably know, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, the book of Daniel. And it's the story. King Nebuchadnezzar sets up a golden idol in his court and he makes a ruling. He says, when the music plays, we're going to play some music every now and then, it's a bit like musical chairs. When the music plays, except that's when the music stops, this time when the music plays, you stop what you're doing, you bow down and worship this idol I've built. Sounds reasonable, sounds easy, fair enough, okay. But Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, they're three Israelites in the court of King Nebuchadnezzar, and they refuse to bow down to this idol. And King Nebuchadnezzar pulls them up and says, okay, let me give you a choice. Here's your choice, okay. You can, when the music plays, you can bow and worship your idol, my idol, or you can go in the fiery furnace. Pretty easy choice, isn't it? So what are you going to do? And they say, no, we are not going to bow to this idol. And Nebuchadnezzar says, well then I've got to put you in the furnace. What's your God going to do then? And they say, well, we want you to know, King, that we are not going to bow down and worship your idol. The God we believe in, the God we worship, he is easily able to save us from the fiery furnace. No problem at all. But, we want you to know this, King, but even if he doesn't, we are still not going to worship your idol. That's faith. That's faith. It's not the fact they say, we believe God can save us from the fiery furnace. It's the fact they say, but even if he doesn't, we are still going to worship him. We are still going to trust him. Do you see that? Do you see how that's faith? The faith is them saying, you know, we are not men who believe in God when things go well for us. We are not men who trust God just when the sun is shining. We are men who are going to cling to God even in the storms. We are men who are not going to walk away from God just because things aren't going well for us. We are going to trust God when things are going well, when we are saved from the fiery furnace. We are going to trust God when we burn. That's faith. That's what their faith looked like. Some people, in their suffering, when they're struggling, they try and use that as a weapon against God. They try and blackmail him. Say, God, if you want my worship, you want my attention, you want my love, you've got to do something for me first. You've got to fix this situation in. You've got to save me from this suffering, this problem. But then there are those who, in the middle of suffering, use that opportunity to say to God, God, I just want you to know, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going anywhere. I'm in. I'm with you. In the passage this morning, I think we see that. We see these two extremes. It's almost like this is an example, a zoomed in example of humanity and the way we can respond. And I don't even think it's necessary we can say, you know, there are two groups of people, those who respond this way, those who respond that way. It's almost like this is the battle that goes on in each of us every time we suffer. There's always that conversation between Jesus and those two criminals in us every time we struggle and the suffer. There's the voice, that part of us that says, you know what, this isn't worth it. This isn't working out very well. This is hard. This is painful. And God's nowhere. God is absent. But then there's that other voice that says, but I still want to trust. I still want to believe. I think that happens in all of us. I think this crucifixion scene plays out again and again and again in our own lives whenever we face suffering. But the thing to remember, in the middle of our suffering, in the middle of our own crucifixion, that Jesus is right there too. That's the truth, is that Jesus is right there next to us in the middle of that. All we need to do when we are being crucified by life is look around. Look around. It's suffering that distorts our perspective. It's suffering that tells us that God is absent, that God is not present. Now, I don't believe, for you or I don't believe God is ever absent. But I do believe, I do know that sometimes it feels like he is. Sometimes it feels like he is. But it's suffering that makes us feel like Jesus doesn't care. It's suffering that makes us feel like God's gone on holiday. It's suffering that makes us feel that way. But if you look with eyes of faith, you'll see something very different. For the criminals, the cross was actually where they met Jesus and had their chance to respond to him. The suffering was the place where God met them. In 2 Kings chapter 6, the king of Aram, he's got a problem with the prophet Elisha because he keeps trying to wage war against Israel, and Elisha, the prophet, keeps telling the king of Israel, this is what the king of Aram's going to do, and spoiling his big plans. So the king of Aram's had enough. And he says, right, we're going to get Elisha. So they send some troops to the city of Dothan, where Elisha is. And they surround the city and they say, bring us, you know, we want Elisha. And Elisha's servant is terrified because there's this army at the gate saying, we want your master and you, because you're his servant, come out. And Elisha says, Lord, I pray that he may see the truth. And the servant looks out. And behind the army of the king of Aram, he sees countless, a multitude of horses and flaming chariots. And Elisha says, you see, those who are on our side far outnumber those who are on the king of Aram's side. And we find ourselves in that kind of situation where we look out in the middle of our suffering and all we see are the horses and the chariots of the enemy stacked against us. And it's the eyes of faith that we need to pray for, that we can see actually that Christ is right there with us in the middle of it. This is a vertical slide. It's called a vertical slide. It's in this one particular one is in a place called Bendigo in Australia at the Discovery Centre. Now you might be able to see from that, it looks just like a slide, but the clue's in the name. It's called the vertical slide because the first bit, you might be able to see better, the first bit, The gradient is imperceptible. It's practically vertical for the first bit. And the way you do it, let's see, you see there's someone there, that a child, And he's holding onto a bar. Now, let me just clarify. He's not kind of leaning against the back of the side. He's holding onto a bar, dangling, nothing around him, looking down at a drop, a sheer drop that in the distance sort of curves into a slide. Can you picture that? I've been on this thing, and let me tell you, when you're hanging there, looking down, and you can just see this drop, everything in you says, you know what, James, this is a bad idea. This is not good. Your eyes look and you can just see the drop. Your body is telling, your mind is telling you, look, this is not, you don't want to die this way. This is not good. But in the middle of that, while you're hanging there and everything in you is saying you're just going to drop, you're just going to fall, there's a guy, there's an employee of the Discovery Center right there in your ear, the guy of experience who's been there every day, and he's saying to you, it's fine, don't worry. No one's ever hurt themselves yet. No one's ever died. Just trust me. You're fine. Just let go. And you do. You let go, and for a second or two, you're free-falling, and your body's saying, well, okay, well, that's it then. And then all of a sudden, you glide gently down to the bottom of the slide. It's science, apparently. They've worked it out, the gradient, how it works. It's quite an amazing thing. But for that moment when you're hanging there, everything in you is saying one thing, which is, don't do this. This is stupid. But the guy who works there, the guy who's seen people go down this slide dozens, hundreds of times, is saying, actually, it's fine. And that's kind of where we're at with this choice. Everything in us, when we're struggling and suffering, everything in us are, we look at life, everything we trust about ourselves is saying, God is absent, this is bad, what's the point, give up. But there is a voice in our ear, the voice of Jesus on the cross next to us, saying, it's fine, it's okay, trust me, I'm here. And we have to make that choice. And it feels real. It feels real that, you know, this pain, this terrifying feeling we're having, this is real. And you have to choose. What am I going to believe? Am I going to believe everything that my body is telling me? Or am I going to choose to believe this voice, this still small voice to my side, which is saying, today you will be with me in paradise. Isn't that what Easter is about, really? Easter is the moment where God says, you know all the old rules that you live, you die? All those old rules turned on their head. And there is life. Death becomes life. Now everyone thinks that's crazy. That's stupid. Death is death. Death is the end. But Easter says no. Death is not the end. It looks like the end, but it's not the end. And in our moments on that cross, when being crucified, we feel like this is the end. This is the end. Everything, it feels like it's the end. There's that voice that says, no, it's not the end. It's not the end. Trust me. Suffering, even suffering, that's one of the most amazing things, I think, about the crucifixion and the resurrection, is that even suffering can be used by God to bring his kingdom. There is nothing that cannot be used by God. That is how amazing it is. That there is nothing in your life that cannot be used by God. No matter how difficult or painful it seems. So if it's true that Jesus is right there in the middle of your suffering with you, what are you going to say to him? This is your opportunity to speak to him. This is your opportunity to say something to him. Are you going to say like the first criminal? Are you going to say, look, Lord, if you're so good, if you're so great, why are you letting this happen? I demand something different. Or are you going to make that choice to say, Lord, I choose to believe that you've not abandoned me. You haven't gone on holiday. You're here with me in my suffering. You're right here with me. And even if it continues, I will trust you. I will hold on to you. I will not abandon you. When you hear this story, use this story to remind you that this is of this true. Get things in your life that remind you that even when we feel like God is absent, like God is away, He's not. He's here. He's with us. So that you can say, like the second criminal on the cross, like Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, like Elisha, like so many other men and women of faith throughout the centuries, you can say, Jesus, you know what? This doesn't change a thing. I'm still yours. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. Let's just have a moment of silence. Reflect. Father, I pray that in those moments where we're convinced that you've gone away, Father, I pray that we will see, we will choose to see with eyes of faith that you're actually right next to us. You are near to us. And I pray, Father, that in those moments where it seems foolish to believe you, seems foolish to side with you, I pray that we will have the courage and the strength to make that choice to cling to you. Amen.